Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
And I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And we are, the two of us are flying duo. We're flying without Devendra and Chris this week, who are there completely swamped with work stuff. As we do record this on a school night, sometimes that does happen, and our co-hosts do get bogged down. Like last week, you were out, Dwayne, because you
right. Well, last week I was in Maui for a wedding, so oh. I can't say that it was for a school night time.
You're probably not suffering too much.
Yeah, I'm not. Well, I mean, it's all good news though. These are the best kinds of problems. The Ranger's at a conference for VentureBeat. Yeah. It's happening on the West Coast, so he's kind of got to be there for the mixer kind of thing. I know there's some stuff going on the East Coast too. I think that's what he's associated with. But VentureBeat's doing really well. And then Chris is working on something for Startup Digest. So, I mean, these are good problems to have.
Yes.
And that's kind of why we have four people.
Exactly.
When, what was it? The engines?
Yeah, the drill down's like a plane with four engines. And two of the, as long as we have at least two engines, the plane will stay aloft. When we're down to one engine, then we start spiraling like towards the earth in a crash and burn. And right. on those days, there probably won't be an episode of The Drill Down. But we're good now because we got you and I, and I think we're well suited to fly solo, fly duo, fly on two engines.
That reminds me of the Avengers in the beginning when the super carrier is flying.
Oh, yeah.
Loses that one. It was cool with two engines, but then only one was working or whatever. And it was like, okay, that's going to suck.
They spent a lot of time on that whole, you know, broken engine sequence in general on that film.
Yeah, it's true. They did. But I'm okay with it because the movie, I got to say, the movies that are out now aren't too impressive compared to the Avengers. Like, I was really excited for Prometheus. Yeah. Everyone's kind of complaining about it. I haven't seen it yet, but everyone's complaining about
it. Yeah, I mean, I would say when you go to watch it, kind of watch it with an open mind, but you'll probably come away not overwhelmed, but not, I wouldn't say necessarily disappointed, maybe just not, just try and temper your anticipation. Yeah,
your so you're saying I won't be overwhelmed. And I won't be underwhelmed, so I'll just be whelmed.
You'll be whelmed. As I was. I was completely whelmed by Prometheus. So we're coming to you live on Geeks of Doom, as we do every week. And this week, we look at the latest hardware and operating system updates from Apple's Worldwide Developer Conference held this week in San Francisco. And then we're going to take a look at the complex, ambiguous minefield of policing copyright infringement. But first, as we do usually every week, we talk about some of the gadgets and apps and other gizmos that are exciting us in a segment that we like to call What We're Playing With. And I'm not playing with anything exciting this week in particular, but you, Dwayne, you told me that you're playing with something exciting this week.
Yeah, so before I went over to Maui, I realized I was going to be in the plane for like 10 hours, and so was my girlfriend. And what typically happens is one ear from my iPad, one earphone was in her ear, one earphone was in my ear. And like for 10 hours, that's kind of like not okay. So I went and I gave her my iPad 2, and I bought an iPad 3.
You have the new iPad with the Retina display.
New iPad, Retina display, 64 gigabytes, AT&T, you know, LTE, the whole shebang.
What do you think about it? You have been an iPad owner, owner of just a standard iPad. Is owning an iPad with the Retina display, is that a quantifiable, like, improvement in your life? Is that...
It's interesting. So I have an iPad 2 and the new iPad, the third generation iPad. So I have the two latest generations. They're both going to get all these updates soon. I'm kind of excited about it. What I noticed was, one, LTE is a very different beast than 3G, because over LTE you get all these Wi-Fi like capabilities that eat bandwidth up on a whole new level. Within 3 days of owning this thing, I had gone through 3 gigabytes. I had to re-up, which I was fighting to get 3 gigabytes of data's worth on my iPad 2. Like, just like, I want to use all the data. Actually, it was 2 gigabytes on that one because it has a $25 legacy plan. But I try to, like, do it. I try to, like, push it to get to those 2 gigabytes. I could never do it. But within days, and I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that Netflix is coming over at 1080i or 1080p. So that's definitely an issue. Pandora is using, like, it's default to like high def music or something. Each song is 2 megabytes, so you're playing it while you're getting ready in your hotel room, you know, or like, you know, for a bunch of friends or whatever, or you're kind of doing like a little party on your deck or whatever in the bungalow, and you just realize you're eating it up. It's
interesting that you mentioned that. One of the stories that I decided to cut for this week's rundown was on Verizon's recent plan to basically, it was like you can have all you can eat across 10 devices.
Yes. Okay. So we should maybe bring that back.
All right. All right.
Let's hop right into
Let's talk a little bit about that first. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
All right. So Verizon drops this new plan called Share Everything Data for $50, you can get 1 gigabyte of all Share Everything Data. For $100, you get 10 gigabytes of Share Everything Data. So let's just look at what you get when you spend $100 for Share Everything Data.
Mm-hmm.
You get to connect your devices to this data plan on Verizon so that your iPad, your MiFi, your telephone, your sister's telephone, all that stuff can be on the same plan, and it uses the same pool of data. So you don't have separate little like 3 gigabytes for this and 2 gigabytes for that, knowing that your sister may not be using, you know, all the 3 gigabytes that she gets in her normal data plan, but at least you can pick up that slack from your phone usage because you're a data hog or whatever.
Yeah.
So the problem here is, for me at least, that it's not a question of me taking a device that I already own, like an iPad, and hooking it up to this. If I want to connect my iPad to this, it's going to cost $20 extra per month. So for whatever reason, Verizon's saying, you've paid $829 plus tax for your iPad. And now I want you, and you're going to pay me $100 a month for 10 gigabytes of data, but I also want you to pay me $20 just for the privilege of having your iPad connected to this data plan. And to me, that's a little strange. But it gets stranger, Andy. And it gets stranger because if I want to connect my MiFi to this 10 gigabytes of data, mind you, it's the same 10 gigabytes of data.
Yeah.
Right? I then have to pay $30 a month extra for the MiFi because for some reason, the MiFi is more expensive to the Verizon to keep on there than the iPad, which is a little strange because the idea here is that I only have 10 gigabytes of data. So it's not like I'm on some unlimited plan where using the tethering is obviously going to bump my data usage. I still only have 10 gigabytes. So why does it cost me more money to use one device versus another device? And then, of course, if you bring any telephones in, you have to buy a phone plan on top of that. So it's like $30 to $40. It's all that. So you end up not really saving a lot of money if you have moderate data usage.
Yeah. I mean, I think these carriers are just going to find, and especially with text, you know, text is essentially is the printer ink of data bandwidth. It's basically they can charge an exorbitant amount of money for essentially sending text messages over, and they're reaping the lion's share of the profit from that. It's just ridiculous. I think you and I have had a little bit of an argument back and forth about the overall cost to these carriers for providing the data services. I think that once they've laid out the infrastructure, it doesn't really cost them anything to give you that data. And your contention is that they do,
the growth in the smartphone market is moving very quickly, so they're constantly building new towers and putting more stuff up. So the money that we're spending is going toward that maintenance. Obviously, there's a healthy profit margin there. The SMS thing, I am really happy that Apple mentioned that they sent like a billion iMessages, because I think that, that if you add that, you know, if you multiply that by 10 cents, the carriers are missing out on a lot. But you know what? it's a disruptive technology that time has come and that needed to happen. So I'm really happy that, you know, we're using these data services from we're using it over data instead of spending the 10 cents per text message. So I think that the carriers, yeah, they're a little stuck. And maybe you're right. I think that they're trying to kind of get the money that they're losing from the lack of SMS.
Yeah.
In this data thing right now.
I feel like the carriers are at the point that the music industry was a few years ago, where they see essentially that they're on the losing end of this business model. And unfortunately, unlike the music industry, they still do control. They still do have the keys to the kingdom as far as the data goes. So they're going to they realize early on. I mean, I think they realized too late that that when they first started developing plans for data plans, they said, "Oh, all you can eat," because there's no way that anyone is ever going to use up that much data. But now everything is using that much data up, and they're trying desperately to put the genie back in the bottle.
Right, the genie back in the bottle thing is huge. I just also think that what they're doing is, I mean, the idea that $10 per gigabyte of mobile data, I can live with that if that's really what we're going to see. But I don't want to see gigabytes of mobile data that don't get rolled over like the same minutes that AT&T used to use, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like, once minutes got cheap for them, I'm not saying data's cheap for them, I'm just saying, you got to roll over your minutes. And at the end of the year, you had a whole bunch of minutes. If I'm going to pay $10 for data, for a gigabyte of data, let me just pay $10 for a gigabyte of data. Let's just leave it at that, right? So that means I shouldn't necessarily have a buffeted thing. Like, I shouldn't necessarily have, like, for the Verizon thing, 10 gigabytes for a month.
Yeah.
How about you just give me, you just charge me $10 for every gigabyte I use? If I'm going to use 40 gigabytes, charge me $400. If I'm going to use 2 gigabytes, charge me $20. Just allow me to move forward with a pay-as-you-go situation. You have my credit card, and let's stop playing these weird games about you've got this device attached and you've got that device attached or whatever, right? Like, this whole the idea that the T-Mobile guy said people are going to bring their own devices, people are going to do their own thing. I really think that that's what's got to happen. We've got to get to a point where people just pony up for the device. It's going to last you for 3 years maybe, and just like go to whatever carrier they want and pay, you know, have the carriers like dive to the bottom of the pricing channel in order to get the best consumer.
I agree, and, you know, I agree with that basically in that sentiment. I think you're on the right track. I think we're not done with the end of this conversation until the carriers kind of figure out until they reach a compromise with the consumers who want to continue to keep that bottle, that all you can eat bottle, open, keep the genie out of that bottle. Let's move on here. So last week we talked about the huge LinkedIn password leak, and within this last week, last.fm issued a statement saying it's currently investigating whether it too has leaked some of its users' passwords. They're recommending all users log into their account and change their password through the setting page. I've done that on my last.fm account. But I mean, this seems to be like we seem to be seeing a lot more of these password leaks over the last couple of years. They've grown exponentially. I just don't know if it really, as a consumer, it gives me cause to lose confidence in the social services that I subscribe to, since virtually every single one of them has had some form of data leak during some period of their existence.
Yeah, I'm not too worried about this, and the reason why is because I've got information on LinkedIn. Yeah, it's personally identifiable, but I feel like I've kind of been like getting like Last.fm services and LinkedIn services for free with no consequence for a really long time. And this is something I'm thinking about when I do use these services. I'm thinking about the fact that, hey, you know, one day things can happen. Someone can like hop in. What happens if someone like hacks into it? And I also know that while they're doing what they're supposed to be doing for the most part, I mean, not Sony, but everybody else seems to be, in terms of security, you really can't keep a breach from happening. You can't keep every breach from happening. It's going to happen. And luckily, their privacy policies are such that they tell us when that thing has happened so we can figure out the best way to do it. Now, most of us, including me, are mm-hmm. ill-equipped to really take some kind of action once this kind of thing has happened. Yeah, I don't really know what to do. Okay, my stuff might be out there. My stuff may not be out there, whatever. I don't, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that as long as they're open and honest, telling me that they're working on it, I'm willing to take the risk to use these services because they have become essential in the way that I live my life. It's sort of like there's going to be floods. There's going to be hurricanes. It's not quite an act of God, but it's definitely something that's happening. It seems to be happening a lot now.
Yeah.
But I feel like it's happening. It seems to be happening a lot. But that's if you think about it in terms of the data that we're actually using, the services we're using. We're using a lot more services than we used 5 years ago. We're yeah. using a hell of a lot more services than we used 10 years ago. Remember when like, the iTunes store came out or whatever? And I just feel like it's kind of par for the course. I'm not giving them a pass. They should mm-hmm. be working hard to keep things secure. But I do think that you know we're in a situation where the data is where the money is, and we're going to see people both attacking personal systems and enterprise systems in order to get it and use it in random ways. And we just have to be aware of that and know what it is that we have out there and know how to use it, how to protect it when we need to do it, and how to maybe not share things if we're really worried about them and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm willing to take a little bit of a risk myself, too, although I have been burned. You know, literally, at least literally a dozen times through all of my different social services, you know, including some of the most notorious ones like the Sony PlayStation Network one. That was a real pain in the ass.
Yeah.
let's move on here. So Twitter aired its first ever TV commercial this last week during the 2012 Pocono 400 NASCAR race. And the ad was promoting their hashtag pages, hashtag new hashtag branded pages, where they'll take a hashtag like hashtag NASCAR and they'll devote an entire page to it. So if you went to twitter.com/hashtag NASCAR hashtag NASCAR, you'll see that it basically culls some of the most interesting tweets and it curates them onto a single page, like a branded specialized page with tweets from the top, like NASCAR, people involved with NASCAR, and pictures as well. And this is just like the introduction to many other branded hashtag pages like this. What do you think about this idea, Twitter?
I like it. I've tried to use TweetDeck to monitor hashtags, and basically, if it's a popular one, the system gets overwhelmed, eats up all this memory, and shows things more quickly than I can read them. I like the fact that they're curating the experience, and I think that it's just another piece of Twitter's puzzle toward monetization, toward getting brands and events cataloged mm-hmm. and able to be digested by consumers.
Yeah, I think it's a good move on their part. Not much more to say on that respect, but there you go. Okay. Oh, and here's our other. We're zipping through these headlines. This is our last headline before we get into our main topic here. So this happened today. More than 1,000 new internet top-level domains, such as .app, .kids, .love, .pizza, and also .amazon and .google could come online beginning early next year with the potential to radically change the face of the web. But and that is because the ICANN, the U.S.-appointed company that decides what new domains can be added to the web, is rolling out these customized top-level domains. And some people are criticizing ICANN for allowing a commercial land grab of the internet. Because basically with these sites like .shop, .book, .love, mm-hmm. You can only one entity can own that top level domain. And for example, the most applied for domain currently is .app, and 13 organizations have staked a claim to own that domain, including
Amazon. It's just weird that it's kind of, it's like it looks like an extension .app, right? So you can be like maps.app, you know, suppose mm-hmm. Apple's new Maps program, or contacts.app or whatever. It's weird that someone can own the entire extension, because it's top level extension, and it's being treated like a top level domain. Like, I get it. Apple can own apple.com. They're Apple. They've been around since the 70s, whatever. But the idea that Apple owns .com is a little strange. And if we're going to separate ourselves out so we have .xxx and .app, I feel like it shouldn't be a question of straight ownership. It should be a question of application. They should have an infrastructure in place that allows us to, you know, if I'm an app maker and I've got a unique app name, I should be able to get on the web and say, okay, I can. I've got my app. It's called Instapaper, and I want to be Instapaper.app. And I can just say, okay, we're going to check you out, do a little diligence. Great, Instapaper.app, good. You're good to go. Just like you would with an EDU or .net for a telco, you know, or mm-hmm. .org for whatever. These things should be set up so that individuals can get a piece of this instead of these it's like an IPO. Institutional people like Google and Amazon hop in there, and they buy every single one, and then we're stuck, you know, with the dregs. It's not like there's a lot left in .com either.
Yeah. So, I mean, I agree. Like, I feel that it's really weird that they should allow one particular domain to own. I mean, obviously, I can understand where one particular domain would own .apple or .google. That makes perfect sense. But something like .app or I mean, I feel like I can maybe generating this, artificially generating this demand for building this demand for these custom top level domains, like creating an atmosphere where there's a bidding war basically over them.
Yeah, it's pretty weird. Like, it's, I don't know, it's, we'll see how it works out. I'm just kind of like not really confident that these guys are doing anything but setting up a situation that allows them to get a ton of money quickly.
Yeah.
And not really helping out the way the web works. Yeah. And helping out like expanding and just the health of the World Wide Web.
And so, perhaps even confusing consumers a bit more when they go to .app thinking that they're going to get iPhone apps, and it's owned by Google, and all you see is Android apps on there. I don't know. I'm just throwing out a hypothetical there, but I can see.
And there's no, it doesn't seem like there's any real attention to, I mean, like .app.
Yeah.
If you look at the app, I don't think there's a copyright on the term app.
Sure.
But you look at, like, you know, what has Apple been calling their programs for the last 30 years? Apps or applications.
Right.
They have the App Store, Mac App Store. The App Store is the iOS App Store. The other guys don't have that, but they're able to buy it quickly because they're first to market. And they're not Cyber Squad, and they really want to use it. But at the same time, you're right. There could be some confusion there, and it's just kind of, I don't know, it's just kind of weird. But so be it. This is capitalism.
All right. That's it for our headlines. Before we get into our main topic, which is going to be the Worldwide Developers Conference here, I want to talk a little bit about our sponsor, which is Audible.com. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial, 30 days, a whole month, to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book that I'd like to recommend for you this week is called Red Shirts, a novel with three codas by John Scalzi. And it is narrated by Will Wheaton, who is a
Star Trek alum.
Yes. Ensign Wesley Crusher. I would not want anybody else to narrate a book called Red Shirts. But let me tell you a little bit about what this book is about, And then it's you'll see it's all more appropriate that he's narrating this. It takes place in the Star Trek universe, as you would imagine. And it's about Ensign Andrew Dahl, who has just been assigned to the Universal Union capital ship Intrepid, flagship of the Universal Union since the year 2456. Actually, not. It doesn't. Let me backtrack a little bit. It doesn't take place in specifically in the Star Trek universe, but it's hard to confuse it for any other universe. I'll just put it that way.
The
it's
USS kind of Intrepid.
Yes.
As in the Intrepid class the Intrepid class cruiser that
not the USS, the Universal Union capital ship, the UUCS.
Oh,
Intrepid.
That's weird.
That's why it's kind of a parody of the Star Trek universe. But here we go. Life couldn't be better until Ensign Andrew Dahl begins to pick up on the facts that one, every away mission involves some kind of lethal confrontation with alien forces. Two, the ship's captain, its science officer, and the handsome Lieutenant Kerensky always survive these confrontations. And three, at least one low-ranked crew member is, sadly, always killed. Not surprisingly, a great deal of energy below decks is expended on avoiding at all costs being assigned to an away mission. Then Andrew stumbles on information that completely transforms his and his colleagues' understanding of what the starship Intrepid really is, and offers them a crazy high-risk chance to save their own lives. Now, I as soon as I read this summary, I immediately used my monthly Audible credit to buy this book, and I'm going to be reading it right away. And I know, like, Will Wheaton previously narrated Ready Player One, which was another excellent meta parody book as well, so I have a feeling that this one's going to be right in line with that. That it's kind of a meta look at science fiction tropes and how a character from within that science fiction world deals with those tropes, like red shirts always getting killed on away missions. So I'm looking forward to that. And that book, amongst any of Audible's other 10,000-plus offerings, can be yours. And all you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. That's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook or any of Audible's other 10,000-plus titles. I'm sorry, 100,000. Plus titles. I just like downgraded their title account by 10. 100,000 plus titles to choose from, plus a 30-day trial to check out the rest of their services. So please go to that domain, and going there helps us out. So if you're not an Audible subscriber already, which you probably should be, go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. It helps our show out. We're going to take a little break here, listen to some music, and when we come back, we're going to talk about Apple's new updates for their entire line, almost their entire line, at the Worldwide Developers Conference. So take a listen to this, and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down live on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and social media and how it affects us. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas, and let's talk about Apple's Worldwide Developers Conference, which took place in San Francisco just earlier this week. So Apple basically dropped a bunch of new stuff on us. They officially introduced iOS 6, officially introduced the new improvements in what is it, Snow Leopard?
Oh, it's called Mountain Lion.
Mountain Lion.
Snow Leopard was two versions of
it. Right. So Mountain Lion, that shows you how much I pay attention. should we talk about, and of course they updated nearly virtually every piece of hardware in their
laptop
in their laptop line. So what should we discuss first, the updates to the operating system or the updates to the hardware?
I think everyone's talking about the hardware. I think we should probably start there. The new MacBook line and the new MacBook Air. Yeah, the new MacBook line, MacBook Air, MacBook Pro, MacBook Pro Retina display, and even a small update to one desktop device of the three desktops they make. There was a small update to the Mac Pro. And even later on, Tim Cook did come back and say the Mac Pro is likely going to get a refresh
yes.
in 2013.
Yeah, so we'll talk about that in a second. But let's talk about what the major stuff that they announced during the WWDC. Like the highlight, the flagship for this WWDC was the next generation MacBook Pro with the Retina display. So this MacBook Pro has a Retina display and the resolution is 2880 by 1800. It's got a casing that measures just 0.71 inches thin and weighs 4.46 pounds. Apple also mentions that it'll have higher contrast ratios, better viewing angles, reduced glare, mm-hmm. and it's updating all of its stock apps to take advantage of the extra pixels. Aperture, Final Cut Pro. They say reading your mail is going to be like reading fine print. As far as the other specs go, it's going to have 16 gigs of RAM, an NVIDIA Kepler GT 650 megabyte graphics. Up to quad-core 2.7 gig core i7 processor with a maximum of 768 gigs of storage, SSD.
Yeah, and let's go back to that processor.
Uh-huh.
And even before the processor, I want to talk about the fact that these laptops, it's not just a question of the same situation with a faster chip in it. They've moved to the third generation core architecture, which is called Ivy Bridge. So the first generation was, I think, Westmere, then there's mm-hmm. Sandy Bridge, now there's Ivy Bridge. Or I think it was Nehalem, sorry. So this allows for 1600 megahertz RAM up from 1333 megahertz RAM. And the device, also the 2.7 chip, it's turbo boost, meaning when you plug it in and it decides it's going to use more power and clock itself up,
mm-hmm.
the turbo boost goes to 3.7 gigahertz. So we're approaching a 4 gigahertz number at stock.
Insane.
Which is very, very, very
rare.
For a laptop. So it's a very, you know, powerful machine. Also, the power is augmented by the fact that, like you said, it has up to a 768 gigabyte flash drive, a proprietary flash. I'm guessing it's SATA, the latest version of SATA.
Mm-hmm.
But it's proprietary in that Apple has made it so that it's built into the chassis. Everything's built into the chassis. In fact, the RAM is soldered on. So at the purchase point, right now, you have to decide whether you want 8 gigs of RAM or 16 gigs of RAM. Now, the upgrade from 8 to 16 is only $200, which is pretty rare. Right now, you know, RAM prices are falling right now. But it's a pretty reasonable price to have double the RAM, considering what 16 gigs of RAM on a laptop cost maybe 8 months ago. But it's something to think about. And, of course, you can't replace the hard drive. Many people would buy the MacBook or the MacBook Pro, buy their own third-party hard drive, pull it out, put the drive in, and say, boom, I'm ready to go.
Yeah. In fact, iFixit, who usually when a new Apple device comes out, iFixit does a teardown of that device. They called the new MacBook Pro nearly impossible to repair because of how set everything is in, how uncustomizable everything is.
Yeah, I mean, a big part of this also is the idea that this is an integrated system, in order to make it smaller, in order to make it as fast as possible. Again, the RAM is at 1600 megahertz. The disk is SSD up to, you know, 3/4 of a terabyte, which is actually a reasonable size for a laptop disk. All for an extraordinary amount of money. But they've gone even farther. They've gotten rid of the CD-ROM drive, and in that space, they've allocated, you know, two separate fans on either side of the device. The in order to push all this power, because remember, this is taking more electricity because it has more performance. Basically the bottom half of the laptop, the half of the laptop that is between the user and the screen, is now all battery in order to maintain the seven hours of battery life. Now batteries get hot, and hot is a problem. So there are now vents on the sides, the lateral sides, the left and the right of the MacBook Pro with Retina display. Those vents are there to cool down the battery, to keep it cool when it's on your lap, all those things. And we never saw those vents before. The vents used to just be around with the screen, touch the main computer.
Right.
In addition, they've put in two relatively humongous fans for a laptop to keep this thing cool. And these fans are interesting because they've taken the painstaking idea of oscillation and the fact that it makes noise, these fans, and they've made the blades asymmetrical, which means when they spin around, the noise the blades make when hitting the air, it's not hanging out on one frequency. It's hanging out on several frequencies.
Yeah.
So while it's moving the same amount of air, it's doing it in a way. It seems quieter.
Yeah.
It's making the same amount of noise, but because they're on separate frequencies, your ear isn't picking up one frequency at a specific volume. The amplitude is less. So that's another thing that they're doing.
I thought that was really interesting too, where you know, if you saw the they had a video that kind of went through all of the updates in the new MacBook Pro, and Johnny Ive narrated that video, and he basically showed you how most fans have evenly spaced blades, and they've offset the blades in these particular fans, so they're still parallel to each other, but the spacing between each blade is slightly different.
The spacing and the length of each blade is slightly different.
Yeah.
It's a whole thing. So they've thought of, in the last 5 years, everyone's tried to copy the current MacBook Pro's finish, the deep inset keyboard, the glass trackpad, the aluminum architecture, possibly unibody when they could, the wonderful display. Even though Mac doesn't have the Macs don't have the best displays on the market now, they still have pretty wonderful ones. And what they did here is they looked at it and they claimed that they started from the beginning, but it's really a heavy refinement on the outside, and Apple's moving back to this heavily proprietary hardware situation on the inside. Now, the chips are going to be state-of-the-art amongst a device that's like highly competitive between AMD and Intel, that kind of thing. The video cards, all that stuff, that's all kind of like, I wouldn't say stock, but it's all stuff you can get your hands on. But the way the board is laid out, the chipset, all those things, the way the chipset is laid out, all that stuff, that's been proprietarily laid out to serve Apple's ends in terms of serious performance. This is probably going to be the fastest laptop for quite some time.
Yeah.
And extreme battery life. There are not many laptops out there that do get, that even claim 7 hours of battery life with this kind of performance. So you'll get like a laptop like DaVinci's old Asus, which got 8 hours of performance, but was running some sort of super low, ultra low voltage chip. This is running the state of the art, fastest screaming V8 chip you can get. When I say V8, I mean like a car. It's like a V16, really, with all the other things they put on it. Supercharged. But it's getting more battery life than your average run-of-the-mill machine. So it really is a premium device. And because of that, a fully loaded version of this computer costs pretty much $4,000, which is a lot of money. Now, the Retina display is a powerful thing. It's very difficult to get all those pixels in the screen. They've doubled the standard display of the previous MacBook Pro. Which means that you can run 1080p video in the puppy and still have your Final Cut Pro, the full option of menus all around it. Yeah. And that's pretty exciting. But it also means it's really, really hardcore. What we're looking at here is a supercar of a laptop.
Yeah.
This is not the MacBook Pro you get. It's really a MacBook Pro. It's for professionals. Right. In terms of the pricing and the performance. Right.
Photographers, I would completely, like, this is a must-have for photographers, for sure, I feel. And maybe even some videographers with the whole, with the ability to have, like, they demonstrated the a screen on the Final Cut Pro X, where they were able to display a 1080p video. Like the 1080p video,
The 1080p video sitting there, and there's still the ability to have every. It's a native resolution in every single menu option,
right?
And like piece of the interface of the
The only downside of that, of course, is that no serious editor will use the new Final Cut Pro, but beyond that,
a Final Cut Pro 7 is going to look wonderful, I guess. You know,
yes, like it's yes.
It's one of those things. But yeah, so it's a very powerful device. It is the new thing. It's whatever we've all been waiting for. We've been talking about it for a long time. I think this is one of the few times where we looked at it. We knew it was going to be Ivy Bridge, right?
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know that it was going to be – we knew that it wasn't going to have a CD drive, right? Wrong drive, an optical drive.
Yeah. So but no we, optical drives, no Ethernet, and no
– Yeah, that's what we didn't know is what I was going to point out. We did not know that there was going to be no Ethernet. We did not know that there was going to be – no FireWire.
Right.
We did learn, though, that it has two Thunderbolt ports. One, you know, obviously plug in your cinema display or whatever you've got.
Yeah.
Two, they sell dongles now that are for the Ethernet connection, that are for the FireWire connection. And with Thunderbolt speeds, you'll be getting the raw power of those connections. So that's pretty nice. They've also got, in a first for an Apple laptop, an HDMI port. So in addition to the two Thunderbolt ports, you have an HDMI port, which means out of the box, sitting down on your desk without a whole lot of work, without two Thunderbolt displays, you can plug in three separate displays as long as you have a dongle for two of them. This is a very big deal. And especially because right now, if you want to run two big screens off of your MacBook Pro, you've got to buy a separate box, which takes the two monitors, and it tricks the computer into thinking they're one big monitor. So they have to pretty much be the same size in order for you to have like a good time with this. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, $200 for the box. If you put the dock over there, the dock is split in half. It doesn't look very good. It's very annoying. Otherwise, you have to do a daisy chain with Thunderbolt displays.
Right.
That's $2,000 right there. So right now, you can put your Mac down, plug in an HDMI display, get your 1080p going. Not the most amazing screens in the world, obviously, but still, out of the box, it's a connection that does not require a dongle. And if you've been in my office where someone walks into a room to present, whether it's a Dell laptop with a mini display port or a Mac laptop with a Thunderbolt port, the dongle situation is always painful. Because you're converting into this VGA thing. It's going to change the resolution of your monitor. It's going to do all this other stuff. Some people have to restart their Macs, all these things. Now with HDMI, you just plug in HDMI. You've got a screen right there. Now, are all projectors HDMI? No. But a growing number of them have that feature.
Most of them are, yeah.
No, most projectors are VGA.
You're right about the
most office projectors remain VGA. Yes, so they have an ancient standard. Yep. But a big thing here is you can plug it directly into an HD TV.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you have an Apple TV and you've got Mountain Lion, you can always do the AirPlay thing. But for people who don't have that, you can plug your computer right into an HD TV without even thinking about it, without a converter cable, without any kind of whatever. It's a lot like the Mac Mini. They're realizing the use case for these things, and you're really being able to use it. So
it's interesting that you mentioned that about the use case, because, I mean, I feel like that's like they abandoned their FireWire 800, which was almost completely a proprietary Apple port, since virtually nobody else in the hardware industry were using FireWire 800 ports. They abandoned that in favor of USB 3, and they abandoned Ethernet in favor of wireless, completely wireless. And I think that is all reflective of the use case, the research that they've done as far as how people have been using these devices. People don't plug into Ethernet anymore. People have almost never used FireWire 800 except for, the only time I've ever used FireWire 800 on an Apple is for my little LaCie portable drives. Otherwise, it's virtually everything else I use is USB.
Yeah. I mean, and that's because USB took over the market. FireWire is still faster. Also, we forgot to mention the USB ports on this device are now USB 3.
Yeah.
Only USB 3. It's not like a lot of the Windows machines where there's some USB 2, there's some USB 3. They're all USB 3 across the entire Apple line now.
Yeah.
The laptop line, at least. So that's a big deal. But I think what we're seeing with the Thunderbolt is that Thunderbolt allows you to have these changes. When you plug a – like when you're on an old MacBook Air and you plug an Ethernet port and you have Gig E and you plug that into the dongle and that goes into USB 2, you're losing speed. You're not getting the full power of that Gig E connection.
Mm-hmm.
You're not. That's not a question here. With Thunderbolt, you're getting that Gig E connection because that's what it is, Gig E.
Right.
So I really feel like they're able to do this now because the hardware is caught up. And I wonder if we're going to be seeing more light peak based I/O connectivity
devices.
That's
a good question.
Like on the new laptops that want to copy.
Yeah.
What Apple's trying to do.
That's a good question. I mean, I feel like Thunderbolt is what, at least a year old, maybe 2 years old at this point?
Thunderbolt is like it's 2011, I believe. I don't believe it's quite 2 years. I think it's like, you know, a year and a half.
And people still haven't – we still haven't really ramped up to
– it's unclear whether Thunderbolt is Apple only, whether other light peak – like I know Sony has a light peak connection for a laptop that they created that is ultra thin, mm-hmm. but plugs into an external video card and other things.
The interface is the same,
but the interface is actually it looks like a USB.
Oh, connector. Really? Okay, because
yeah.
I was under the understanding that the interface is the same. But Thunderbolt's just Apple's own kind of generic name for that interface, just like FireWire versus IEEE, whatever the designation was. For
right.
FireWire. Let's talk about some of the other updates to their line before we get into the software updates. So they updated the MacBook Air the MacBook Airs as well.
MacBook Airs now have Ivy Bridge. They have USB 3 connections. The screens are the same. The SSDs have doubled in size, mm-hmm. so I think for $999 you get 128 gigabytes on the 11-inch, that sort of thing. So it's the same computer for the most part, but you're getting more for the same money.
The 13-inch one has a 1440 by 900 screen.
Yeah, it's had that before.
It has?
Oh. Yeah. So you should have. If you look at your MacBook Air right now, you should see that screen. So it's – I mean the MacBook Airs are great. Like the default – actually, no, the 999 11-inch is still 64 gigabytes. You can upgrade it for $100 to 128 gigabytes. The 13-inch MacBook Air is 128 gigabytes to start. You can upgrade it to 256 gigabytes. At its highest range in terms of stock, you get it for $1,500. You can always upgrade the CPU and get a little bit more out of it. They're still using 4 gigabytes of RAM. Spending $1,500 on a 4 gigabyte RAM machine, people might balk at that right now. But then again, that's the top of the that's the top of the line MacBook Air you're getting. When you move over to the MacBook Pro, it's a little confusing because there are now three separate lines of MacBook Pro.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is 13-inch, 2.5 gigahertz, 13-inch, 2.9 gigahertz. So the 13-inch is still there. It comes with 8 gigs of RAM if you get the higher end one. And the battery lasts still 7 hours, and you're getting a 2.9 gigahertz chip, Intel Core i7, Ivy Bridge. So that's what you're getting, $1,500 for the 13-inch MacBook Air. But you are getting a worse resolution than the MacBook Air when you're buying the MacBook 13-inch, the MacBook Pro 13-inch. So for the MacBook Air 13-inch, you're getting 1440 by 900. For the MacBook Pro 13-inch, you're getting 1280 by 800 in terms of your resolution. So you're getting more computer in some respects. There's still a CD-ROM drive. You can switch out your hard drive, your RAM, all that stuff. But you're not getting a tight screen. And you're getting the same exact Intel HD Graphics 4000. So there's that. The 15 inches, priced at $1,799 and $2,199 respectively, you're getting 2.6 gigahertz quad-core power. when it comes to the Ivory Bridge in there. The higher end one, again, it comes with 1,800 gigabytes and a normal hard drive at 750 gigabytes. And it's got two video cards, the Intel 4000 that you've seen in the last two, in addition to the GeForce 650. And it comes in two flavors, 512 and 1 gigabyte. And then finally, we have the one we've been speaking about, the 15-inch Retina Display Mac, which is a whole new animal. Yeah. And it's another reason I want to mention that the price is really high on this on Retina Display Mac. They're still keeping around the old form factor because the price is really high on the new one. So the old form factor, you're getting a really decent machine, quite a powerful machine,
mm-hmm.
for $2,200, $2,199. And if you want to really go crazy, you can spend basically $2,000 more or $1,800 more
right.
on getting the latest top of the line, yeah. early super awesome thing. Now, as a person who's been looking at the tech industry for quite some time,
yeah.
whenever Mac launches a new platform, whenever Apple launches a new platform, there will be the faithful that will jump to it because they have the cash, or they don't have the cash, but they really want the toy.
Yeah.
And then the people like me who want to just take a look at it for a while, yeah. see what happens. Because right. when the first iPhone came out, it was really cool. It lacked a whole bunch of things like copy and paste, but it was really cool. But then the next iPhone came out, and it had a 3G antenna, and it was smaller, and it was thinner, right. and it was faster. And you're like,
yes.
I mean, it was faster by a lot. It was like, you know,
yes.
it just – maybe it wasn't faster by a lot, but it seemed snappier by a lot. And it had, you know, OS 2 on it and all this other stuff.
For exponentially not that much more than the first generation.
And it was cheaper.
Yeah.
By, like, you know, because it was subsidized.
Yep,
so that's
yep.
that's one of the things. So, I mean, it was just kind of it's one of those things where you have to really look at what it is that you're – if it's worth getting it
in the very beginning. You save money on the second but if you were to wait and not buy the first generation, buy the second generation of this new iteration, then you're actually going to be saving money.
Right. For the most part. We saw that with the MacBook Air. We saw that with the iPhone. We even saw that with the iPods. So I really feel like it's definitely awesome. Obviously, like, who wouldn't want this machine? It is, like, the awesomest machine ever. But
if you don't have to live on the bleeding edge of technology, then wait a revision.
Exactly, because you'll probably be happier for it.
Yeah,
even though you won't be as cool as some people who drop $4,000 a machine.
Before we move into the OS stuff, let's briefly talk about the Mac Pro. Okay, so people kind of had expected that during this WWDC that there was going to be a complete update to the Mac Pro, as there was with
or an announcement that it's over.
Yes, a lot of people were expecting that as well, and some people are feel like. If the Mac Pro were to go away, they wouldn't miss it because they're getting virtually that much power out of these MacBook Pro.
Or offerings. So they think. I mean, honestly, if you look at, even though those machines are running an older chipset, the Xeons, the instruction sets that they run for the applications they're meant to run do have real world performance benefits over the laptops.
In fact, the system that I'm broadcasting right now is a Mac Pro. A 2008 Mac Pro. I think that was the year that came out. But so nothing. There was an incremental upgrade to the Mac Pro, but nothing nowhere near what people are expecting. And so people had generally written the Mac Pro off. But then this is really interesting. David Pogue of the New York Times. Had gotten some information from, I believe, directly from Tim Cook. There was a reader who had emailed Tim Cook and about his disappointment in the lack of a significant Mac Pro update. And Tim Cook responded indicating that users can expect significant upgrades next year, 2013. Our Pro customers are really important to us, he said. Don't worry, as we're working on something really great for later next year. And then Forbes followed up with an Apple spokesperson who said the new designs of the Mac Pro as well as the iMac are in the works and likely to be released in 2013.
Right, and so I mean that's interesting because the only desktop that's been getting some love in terms of redesign was the 2010 Mac Mini.
Right,
that got a redesign.
Right.
It basically got conformed to the current aluminum lineup. And I think the reason why it got that redesign was mostly because it used to be that the Mac Mini and the MacBook, the just plain MacBook, they were the same platform in terms of internal hardware.
Mm-hmm.
When the MacBook Air became the basic low-rise machine, like the kind of low-end machine, the basic machine, they retired the MacBook. They basically flipped the Mac Mini to reflect that. So that's why when the MacBook went away in 2010, the MacBook Air kind of became the standard. The Mac Mini got its update as well.
Yep. Okay, so let's talk about some of the OS stuff. I'm going to start with the smaller announcement, which was the Mountain Lion stuff. So Mountain Lion got an official kind of introduction during the WWDC, and they focused on a few key items when discussing it, including iCloud, 125 million registered users so far. Notification Center is coming to the iMac, to the OS 10. Notification Center already exists on the iOS, and I love it, frankly. And I think that idea, rolling that idea back out onto the
It's a little sad because Growl was already there with that.
Right, and we're going to get to that in a minute because you brought up an interesting post that we'll talk about in a minute about how all the services killed by the announcements that Apple made during WWDC. Dictation, users can now speak, and OS X will convert spoken words to text in any application. Sharing one location to share any file, web page, and more using any integrated third-party service. A new Safari browser. Something called PowerNap. And that will allow Mountain Lion to continue updating with new notifications and perform other functions while the computer is asleep. It's compatible with recent MacBook Airs and the new MacBook Pro. AirPlay mirroring. Full AirPlay support with up to 1080p HD resolution. And Game Center is coming to OS X as well, Mountain Lion as well. And more importantly, above all of this, is that the upgrade is only going to cost $20. So,
you don't think the most important thing is Game Center?
Well, Game Center is important too.
No, it's not. Game Center is the dumbest thing ever.
I'm interested. Well, you know what? Because Game Center is kind of. Like, there are other services that are already, like Steam, if you're using the Steam platform, you already have achievements collected in there as well. So is Game Center going to supplant that, or is it going to be, I don't know.
I mean, Game Center is another one of those Apple trying to be social, just like how Google's trying to be social, and these guys just kind of don't get it.
Right.
Which is why, like, Facebook and Twitter are built into OS X 10.8 Mountain Lion.
And speaking of that, ping. So I think basically they learned their lesson with that. And ping, which is the social sharing service on iTunes, is going away because essentially no one was using it. And I think maybe you have a point there with Game Center. Maybe they'll end up killing Game Center. The way they've just announced that they're not officially announced, but it's rumored that they're going to be doing with Ping.
Right. I mean, it also, it's going to focus on those games that you get from the Mac App Store. Many people still get their games off of Steam, even on the Macintosh. Also, the problem with Game Center for me is that the only time I really go to Game Center is to ignore requests to be friends with people I don't know.
Aw, that's sad. Well, you know, that's exactly what my feeling about Ping is, that the only time that I would go to Ping is to, when I would get, I'd have to turn Ping off when I'm getting invitations to join people on Ping.
Yeah, I mean, it's so, I don't know. I'm unimpressed with Google, Apple, and even Microsoft's approaches to a social. I mean, the only thing that Microsoft's ever done right in social is to, invest in Facebook. That's about it.
All right, let's talk about some of the iOS announcements, which I think iOS was a major
Although let's not sleep on that. I mean, the idea that bringing notifications, bringing simpler interfaces to the main, Mac OS is a big deal. Let's also not forget that there is going to be some crossover in terms of you can now share tabs between them and Safari, mm-hmm. which might make people actually use Safari instead of Chrome. So there are some interesting innovations in terms of that kind of seamlessness that you should expect. It's great that your apps can update at night when you're sleeping on your MacBooks that are on your Mac laptops. I mean, that's a great, great thing. No one wants to spend time clicking OK and then waiting for it to do whatever. So that's a great thing. I think that there's a lot of little things, but if they're going to be updating the OS every year, as we suspect, mm-hmm. then we can expect incremental improvements and not watershed improvements.
Yeah, and I think the improvements will be more in line with we'll see some improvements for the mobile OS, and then followed by incorporating those same improvements into the platform OS, and the server OS. So I think we're going to see a lot of mirroring between OS 10 and iOS in the coming years.
Yep.
Okay, so they made a lot of announcements involving iOS. Let's start with Maps. So they introduced Maps, which is going to replace Google Maps on the portable devices, and it's a completely new app.
Well, it's still Maps. Let's make sure that it's clear. Maps has always been Maps. Apple designed and created Maps.
Yeah.
Previously, they used Google's data for the back end, which is why it looked like Google and just seemed so googly, data provided by Google. Mm-hmm. Now they're using their own homebrew. So it's still Maps. It's still their thing. They still control it, but it is going to be different.
Right. The data is theirs now. And it's newly designed Maps. They're vector-based, graphics and text, zoom all the way in, panning is smooth. They're going to have turn-by-turn navigation, which is something that the mobile community has been begging Apple for years, ever since Maps came out, essentially.
Google also released turn-by-turn navigation back in 2009 or 2020, I think early 2010
but
or whatever.
It wasn't active on iOS.
Not active on iOS, but Google data and on Android and Apple users, iOS users were like, hey, we want this functionality. Yeah. We want it for free. We want all that stuff. And, they never really got it.
Right.
And, unless you wanted to go to MapQuest.
Well, let me ask you a question now. Should Google be nervous about not having Google Maps on iOS anymore?
Not at all. Any person who sat back and said, oh, man, I mean, I like this Maps application, but it doesn't have what I want, is not the iOS user that Apple wants. Go to the App Store, look for what you want, see if it's there. Mm-hmm. MapQuest is a free app that does have turn-by-turn directions, which got completely re-engineered a week ago in anticipation of this event, because turn-by-turn will not be available on every single thing. We'll talk about that later. Google now has an opportunity, because the relationship is over with Apple directly, to make a kick-ass iOS Maps app. And it may not be the default one when some other app needs to point you to where you're supposed to go or whatever, but it doesn't mean that they can't take share away from Apple. Are they incentivized to? Maybe, maybe not. I mean, they're not going to be making ad money off of this. They're not going to be getting money from Apple off of this. Who knows? It might also be a place for them to say, hey, look, if you want the best mapping application out there, you should come to Android, because mm-hmm. we've got it. And we're going to be missing stuff from this new Maps app. It no longer has the Street View stuff that we see on the current iOS 5 Maps
app.
And it's got this thing called Air View.
Flyover.
Flyover. And it's cool, but it's not Street View. It's not the idea that when I'm on the ground and I'm looking for something, I want to be able to Street View and say, oh, that's the exact address. That's what the building looks like. That's what I need to be looking for. That's not there anymore. Also, you don't get Flyover if you're on a 3GS. Which means, you can't, if you're on a 3GS, you don't have any, you've lost functionality, and the 3GS is still a pretty popular phone. So if you're on a 3GS, you're gonna lose this ability to do Street View on your iOS if you upgrade to 6, and you're not gonna get anything to replace it. So
right, and the 3GS won't have
turn by turn either.
Yeah,
but they're not missing anything because they never had turn by turn.
Right, right.
So and a lot of people are like, oh man, I'm not getting this, I'm not getting that. Well, you never had it before.
Well, I wonder if there's going to be an ability to still be able to use Google Maps independently of the Maps app. Like,
well, that's what I'm saying. Like, Google can make their own map app if they want to now, but they don't have to. And they may choose not to get people to say it's a move over to Android, which could totally happen.
I don't know if that's enough incentive to move over to Android, but I'm kind of a dyed-in-the-wool Apple.
You're the faithful.
I'm the faithful. However, I'm not a zealot. I'm not a fanboy. I would like to defend my love of Apple there by saying that. Siri, they're going to be bringing Siri to the iPad, which I think is a... amazing thing. And Siri also...
Who knew, right?
Well,
I mean, I had given up on that a long time ago.
I think we had kind of predicted that that might happen.
I thought it would be there at launch, if anything. I'm surprised they're waiting until iOS 6. I mean, it's on iOS 5 a slower computer.
Isn't the idea that they were kind of reinforcing their infrastructure, their servers, because Siri is an incredible server load.
No, I think you're right. I think that we don't think about the fact that Siri does a lot of work on the back end, on the servers. But I thought it was interesting that it wasn't on the iPad 3 because the iPad 3 is a more powerful device than the iPhone 4S. It's using the A5X processor. It has all the audio capabilities and that the nuance that the iPhone 4S has that the iPhone 4 doesn't, which is why the iPhone 4 doesn't have it. The only devices that will get Siri are A5 Plus devices. Because that chipset is what works with Siri the best. So it's just kind of like, it's just strange to see that it wasn't there in the beginning. I'm glad it's there now.
Yeah.
I'm interested in seeing what Siri's like on a non-mobile device. Frankly, I kind of wish that Siri was coming in Mountain Lion to the new Macs. I wish that was happening because I feel like Siri, like I walk in my house and I want to say, hey, computer, what's up? Like, tell me what's going on.
Right.
I want Siri to possibly wake me up. It's taking power nap. Wake up and say, Dwayne, wake up. Temperature today is this. Your stocks are this. Like, be the personal assistant. You know what I mean?
Right.
So,
well, maybe that's coming.
Well, that's the thing with Apple. It's always coming. It's just the agenda and the speed at which it comes is a problem.
Siri will be able to pull in sports info from Yahoo. Also, better restaurant integration with Yelp and OpenTable, Rotten Tomatoes with movies, and Siri will now be able to launch apps. So you can say, you know, play Temple Run and it'll launch Temple Run.
Yeah, launching apps is really big. I think the whole thing with the integration with Yelp, I mean, they partner with Yelp in a big way. They partner with Yelp in the Maps application where Google has purchased Zagat.
Right.
And is using Zagat in its recommendations now. They've partnered with Yelp in the Maps application. And in the Maps application, they no longer have the access Google had to transit directions. So if you're in my metro area and you want to hop on a bus from Boulder to Denver because you know you're going to get drunk off your ass that night and you want to take a bus back instead of driving, you used to be able to just say, all right, give me these directions, let me choose transit. And it would tell you very up-to-date information on when the bus schedule was working. With what Apple's doing now, they're farming you out to local transit applications. But I've been playing with iOS 6, and it's not a very robust system yet. Like, I've been playing with iOS 6's developer beta, so it's a beta. It's not finished. But not every locality has what Google had. Google had an encompassing pull in there. And it's a bit of a shame that Apple doesn't have that. Although, if Apple were to do that, it would be eating up, you know, instead of using Google's data, okay, you're using Google's data, it's fine. But for you to go out and do it yourself, you're going to be eating up more revenue from more app developers. And that's a big problem. So this solution is a little messy, especially for Apple. And it's a little disappointing. And if you're going to Europe, forget it.
All right.
You're going to be SOL when it comes to getting transit directions.
Siri is going to be partnering with some auto manufacturers to provide what they're calling eyes free, which essentially means there's going to be a button on some of the car steering wheels, and you push the button and that will automatically activate Siri through your through the car controls.
It's hardware integration for iOS devices and automobiles. It's kind of astounding. It also means that when you're talking to your telephone and Siri's talking back to you, it's not going to light up the screen. The idea is to keep your eyes on the road and continue to move forward. So for all those people who thought Apple might come out with an iPad in the car, things like that, it's definitely a step in the wrong direction for those people. Because what Apple's saying is, we don't want your eyes on a fancy, bright touchscreen. We want your eyes on the road. So, and this might be what Siri's all about. You know, hands-free. Seriously, hands-free.
Better Facebook integration. It's baked into the, it's going to be baked
not
in
better,
there.
Not better, just actually there.
Yeah.
Facebook integration.
You sign in with the with Facebook that's baked into the iOS, and then any other app that that integrates Facebook, you don't have to sign in with again, which I think is great, because I use on like about half of the apps that I use, particularly the social network apps, they require some sort of Facebook sign in, OpenID sign in to log into the apps. And for every single one that I go to, I have to log into a separate Facebook OpenID login. And now this will take care of that, essentially. Also, a new phone app, entirely new phone app that allows
you... first updated in like 5 years.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Since the original.
Since the
original. This is great. What I love about the phone app is that one of the things that I love about it is the geofence feature. So essentially, it will set up a reminder to call someone back. Like, you can ignore someone, and you have a choice now. You can reply with a message or ask iPhone to remind you later. And then if you do remind me later, you can set up a geofence around where you are so that, like, as soon as you leave the room or move to another physical location, it'll say, the iPhone will say, hey, you know, do you want to call this person back now that you've left this area? Like, say you're at a meeting. Now that you've left the meeting, you might want to call this person back.
I don't know about that feature. I tried the whole geofence reminder situation, and all it does is eat battery life, because it pops open your location services, your GPS, and it sits there. So for the duration of your meeting or whatever, you're like just chewing on battery. I feel like I prefer the timed reminder. You know, let me know in an hour to give this person a ring back or whatever. I haven't seen anything Android or iOS where geofencing works in a way that doesn't, you know, sacrifice usability later on that day or that night. You know,
FaceTime will be available over wireless. What do you think about this?
It's only going to be available over wireless on iOS 5 device on A5 devices.
So the new iPad.
The new iPad and the iPhone 4S. I think it's cool. I mean, I think the reason is a lot like what you said about Siri. FaceTime is potentially a big bandwidth, you know, hog. So if you limit it to just the new stuff, then you can grow with it. You know what I mean? You can grow your networks to support it with it. It's going to really eat up Tango and a couple other things. But, I mean, I think FaceTime is only really useful if you're on the go. You know, hey, take a look at this thing. Turn your phone around. So I'm kind of excited. It's very futuristic. I wonder how good the quality will be. I'm sure over LTE it'll be fine, but over 4G, I wonder.
Here's an interesting feature, a new feature called Passbook. So essentially this will hold all of your passes, like boarding passes or store loyalty cards or movie tickets. You can get all your passes in one place. It works with other apps that make natural sense, like the Starbucks store app or various apps to buy movie tickets with. So you buy your movie tickets with Fandango or the movies app on the iPhone, and then it will send that ticket to this new Passbook app. You open up Passbook, and that's what you display when you go to the theater or go to Starbucks. You display the Passbook, and your card will be there. I think that's interesting. I think that's something that's probably needed, has been long needed, and it's kind of a halfway step to where some Android devices are now that have
Google Wallet.
Yes, and NFC, near field communications, where you just hold the phone up to a reader and it automatically reads your account information. This is like that halfway step because Apple doesn't have NFC yet, and it can't have NFC in this particular configuration. I can't remember what the reason was, but there's a reason why they can incorporate NFC chips into this.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of feel like it's more than a NFC standby. I feel like what we see here is, I mean, the problem with using your phone to get these kinds of offline transactions taken care of is having to find the app and keep the app open and unlock the phone, because the phone's going to close, the screen's going to turn off when you're like in the airport getting to the front and all that other stuff like that. The idea is to make it just really easy for you to get to that stuff, and the APIs are built in so anyone can use it. And that's, to me, the exciting part, because when I'm in the airport, and I'm in the airport, you know, not a whole lot, but fairly frequently, pulling out my phone and being able to get to it from all this stuff from the lock screen or even at the movie theater or whatever, that's really gonna save time and energy. I also think it's gonna be cool if it keeps those passes, sort of like how I keep movie tickets. It'd be cool if I could keep the movie tickets that are on the thing. It also, they're leaving it to the developers to have their APIs talk to this application, so developers can still do what they want to do, but it gets their apps downloaded more if they know that they're compatible with Passbook. You know what I mean?
Right.
So I think this is it's a win-win, and it's not like an overpromise. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
They're saying the tech exists, we're just going to aggregate it. They're not saying we're going to give you a new way to purchase something or a new way to like get through like an airport or whatever. So they let the tech kind of go. It's a pretty conservative approach to the wallet problem.
Shared photo streams, which is good. You know, now you can send whole photo streams over to other iOS users that you choose. Share your photo libraries. Another feature is guided access, which is great for educational. Basically, it will allow you to lock out portions of the device, either, you know, be it iPhone or iPad. In this particular case, it's they demonstrate it with the iPad, where you lock out even the home button, so you can't. So a kid who is learning a lesson off of the iPad can't accidentally push the home button and go out of that lesson. They're locked into that lesson. I think that's a pretty good idea.
I like it. Yeah, I really dig it, especially because I've seen some really innovative iPad cases for children, like big foam cases with two handles on the sides, things like that. Lock it in there. I also think that this is going to be great for retail. Retail is going to be able to create an app that is installed via the developer license and is sitting on the iPad or the iPhone or wherever, and it's going to be in the shops. Imagine going into the dressing room being able to ask for another size or whatever without having to scream and lean out half naked and ask them, you know, all that stuff. So I think it's going to be pretty helpful for that, because it makes that easier than it has been in the past, and it makes it consumer easy, you know. So there you go.
Any other iPhone features before we talk about what Apple killed with all these announcements?
Any other iPhone features? Bluetooth is now a top level turn switch in the settings app.
Oh, is it really good?
Yeah. So the minute you open up settings, it's like, you know, airplane mode, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth. So your connectivity settings are lumped together. You don't have to go to general and bang in. So that's kind of nice.
I'm so glad about that, because I hated having to drill down into those menus to turn off Bluetooth. What I wish that the iPhone menus would have is what the iPad does, where you double-click the home screen and you can dim the brightness straight from the dock.
Yeah, brightness on the iPad. Although I think brightness on the iPad is a bit more sensitive than brightness on the iPhone.
Yeah.
I do agree with what you're saying. I feel like another thing is that they've merged brightness with wallpaper, so it's in the same thing now. You hit brightness on wallpaper, and you can change the brightness right in there, or you can choose whichever wallpaper you want in order to consolidate those options. The Facebook settings, you can log into Facebook right from the settings. You can log into Twitter right from the settings, and you can install the app if you want, but you don't have to. So there's that.
Let's talk about what Apple killed with their announcement here. There's a list in Business Insider that you sent me the link for, and it was Apple just declared war on these 15 products. And I don't know if I mentioned all 15, but some of the ones that they mention are Google Maps, of course, mm-hmm. we talked about with the maps, optical drives, which we mentioned, Ethernet, hard disk drives. So like, the whole line is SSD now. So goodbye hard. That was a matter of time. We knew that that was.
It is and it isn't. I mean, I kind of had wished that they would allow. Right now, if you buy a MacBook Pro, the regular old school 15-inch uh-huh. MacBook Pro, you can get a kit that would allow you to remove the optical drive and instead install an optical drive replacement where a laptop hard drive fits in. So you have two hard drives on your MacBook Pro. It's a pretty cheap kit. I think it's $50 or $60 or whatever. But basically, you're able to have two. Like as a person who's configured and created desktops, I very much like the idea of having an SSD holding all my OS information, my programs, my apps, you know, 256 gigabytes, whatever. And then a lot of the raw storage going on to a hard drive. Mm-hmm. And it'd be nice if the hard drives, the capacities are powerful. Now that 768 gigabyte SSD costs like $900. 768 gigabyte hard drive costs like $100.
But the two main advantages to hard drives now are price and capacity, right? Because the SSD still can't match either of those.
It still can't match. And I know it's going to go down. I know that Apple, in doing what they're doing, they're going to create...
They're going to drive the market.
Scale
yeah.
in order to pull it down. But in the end, I don't know how effective it'll be simply because they're not using stock hardware. They're using printed on hardware.
Right.
And if ever you have a problem, you know, like it's built into the circuit board. If ever you have a problem with your hard drive, you could always, oh man, this hard drive is going. I'm hearing the clicks. It's right. slow in the performance. It's not booting up correctly. You can do either a pull out, save your data, and like you know reinstall everything on a new hard drive, or you can even do a bit by bit copy over to a good hard drive, and there you go. Who knows what it's going to cost to replace the soldered on, you know, disk
right.
space on this thing. So I'm uncomfortable with the new paradigm.
Well, yes. I mean, I think you do have a point, but I wonder what the rate of failure for SSD drives is compared to hard drives.
I think it's certainly lower, and it's better for a laptop because your laptop is bouncing and stuff.
Yeah.
But you also have to realize that SSDs don't maintain their performance. They dramatically decrease in performance over time compared mm-hmm. to normal hard drives. I don't know what's up with the Apple ones. They could be better, but I've experienced SSD slowdown in a big, big way. So
that's good to know. They also mentioned Dropbox, killing Dropbox because iCloud now syncs all that stuff. Evernote
it's
as well.
Interesting, but it syncs. It only syncs. It doesn't sync documents in terms of files, because again, files aren't around on OS X. It syncs documents,
mm-hmm.
so you can't really get to. You can't really sit there and drag and drop. You know, oh, I worked on this product over here. I'm going to drag it from my box.net into my Dropbox, things like that. It only really like it's just like iCloud. iCloud is not about files; it's about data. So it'll sync your data,
right.
but it's very specific. And it's not; it doesn't really allow for general use. You know what I mean? So it's interesting. Although I think it's a good way to get people to think about buying iCloud, spending more money than the 5 gigabytes that you get for free.
Google Docs with iWork connected now to the cloud. Google Docs. Although you know, I prefer Google Docs, the Google Docs experience on the whole. So I don't think I don't think that affects me at all. I mean, I'm not a huge iWork user as opposed to...
Yeah, also iWork costs money.
Yeah. Google Docs is free. Yeah, I mean, there you go. That's the bottom line. Dictation software, they're saying, is being killed now with Siri built into MacBooks and the iPad.
Yes and yes. I mean, I think Siri's using Dragon's technology
mm-hmm.
in order to do its dictation. I think it's just that it's built in. So Dragon's getting some money. Also, you can get Dragon for free right now in the App Store, and I feel like Apple's probably paying Dragon for the money, so I feel like Dragon is probably doing okay. For the usage, rather, so I think Dragon's doing okay.
Growl, which we mentioned.
Yeah, sad.
Yeah. But, I mean, Notification Center is better, I think.
You haven't played with it, so we don't know. We just know that Growl had support. Right. Growl was innovative.
But if Notification...
I would have liked if Apple purchased Growl instead of just copied Growl.
If Notification Center works on OS, on Mountain Lion the way it does on iOS, I think that's definite improvement. Car navigation systems.
I mean, those went down with Google Navigation. The minute Google Navigation showed up in 2010 or whatever
on Android.
Yeah, on Android, the stock price of both Garmin and like Navigon I think went down by 15%. This is going to drop it even further. But the worst part is, those guys were selling expensive iPhone apps. I think we're going to see those iPhone apps drop from $100 down to like $15 or something like that in order to get that volume, especially for those people who are on the older devices that want the functionality.
Right. Let's see what else. One of the ones that's not on this list that I want to mention is with the Passport. Like one of the recent apps that I've been using is an app called Shop Savvy, which essentially is a library for my consumer loyalty cards, my store loyalty cards, and now that's completely made obsolete by their Passport feature. And I think in a way that's good, because I had spotty success with Shop Savvy. It completely ate my Ralph's card, so I can't use my Ralph's card anymore.
So
hopefully Passport will be a more effective implementation of that loyalty card usage. What else here? Adium. Any other?
I mean, that's a lot of stuff already.
Yep. So all that stuff, but we expect that every time Apple comes out, or
it's in the developer agreement. When you develop for Apple, they say that they can, like, your functionality is basically, it's okay for them to co-opt it into their OS because you're on their platform.
Exactly. Don't build a foundation of your business on something that could be completely taken over by the company
that I wanted to mention. Offline reading lists. Mm-hmm. That's really going to eat into Instagram's lunch, because the fact that you can do the offline reading list on your iOS device and then go home to your Mac and pull that up, that's a bit of a pain.
Instagram, you said?
I'm sorry, Instapaper.
Yes.
Thanks.
Yes.
Instapaper, yeah. My girlfriend was like, no, you mean Instapaper. So Instapaper, you know, fabulous Marco Arment product. Sure. It now has serious competition from Apple in terms of this offline reading. So that's kind of a thing. You do it on, you know, you find the thing, and someone sends you a link over an iMessage, you click on it, I can't read it now. Offline messages, syncs to iCloud, get home. I like to sit in front of my computer or my iPad and just read away, and then boom, it's over there. So, you know, it's a little painful to see that kind of thing show up too.
All right, I think that's it for the Apple announcements. But before we get into our final word here, we're going to take another little break here, take a listen to some music, and then we're going to come back and step into the tricky minefield of policing copyright infringement. So take a listen to this and come on back for our final word.
Wanna
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down live on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Cercini. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas. And a couple of articles, a couple of incidents that spurned a couple of articles this week kind of drove me to this topic of policing copyright infringement. And one of them is this minor article about Pinterest. Pinterest is they're essentially hiring a lawyer from Google. And the reason that they're hiring a lawyer from Google is to deal with specifically a huge portion of the content hosted on Pinterest is copyright content posted without
them. I really wish Chris were here, because this is one of those IP things that I think he would have something interesting to say about as being the person who he is.
Right.
Feel like this is a pretty interesting topic right now. This is the same problem that Google had with YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
You know, copyrighted material from other people now available for free on a website that's not bringing the people who made it any money.
Exactly.
And I mean, I can't blame Pinterest for lowering up that they should. I've heard people say, hey man, you know, I'm going to get on Pinterest. I'm going to throw all these great images I found over here on Pinterest. And like Flickr is made for that. Flickr has the licensing set up. It's got all other stuff. But the idea that, I mean, the sharing of ideas that Pinterest has allowed in terms of visuals, it's really like a child of the second generation of the internet age, you know? But the fact that you can create like a great infographic or some other thing and it gets out there and there are a million copies of it and some of them are low res and some of them are high res and some of them are this and some of them are that and you're not getting anything for it, I can see why a person who's got something special would be upset with the fact that some random person just threw it on Pinterest. You know what I mean?
But you know what's really interesting to me about this whole Pinterest thing is that it seems to me like Pinterest kind of falls under the umbrella of social bookmarking, in that these images that you save on Pinterest all kind of link to other sites.
Social bookmarking takes you to the website.
Yes. Yes.
The throwing an image on Pinterest, it doesn't necessarily take you to the original location of the image if the person went through the trouble of downloading it and then they uploaded it to Pinterest or whatever. Or it might take you to a link that person wants you to go to. Meanwhile, Pinterest has set up so that every affiliate link is one of their affiliate links. So now, if it does go to some sort of commerce-based site, Pinterest is going to probably take a cut of whatever commerce occurs. So Pinterest is making money, theoretically, off of other people's copyright. And that's where the problem shows up. This is where the problem YouTube had. You know, daily shows on YouTube, mm-hmm. YouTube ads all around, that kind of thing. So there are probably a whole bunch of situations that we're not even thinking about that could occur with this kind of thing. And that's why it's a bigger deal. Because if you're a creator and you spend a lot of time coming up with some innovative thing, and someone clicks on your image that happens to be on Pinterest that you didn't put there, and they end up on a website that buys tiddlywinks, you know, but, and they got there because of your image, you're in trouble.
But isn't it essentially the kind of the same situation that Tumblr potentially faces, or the new Delicious? I don't know if you've seen the way the new Delicious their latest iteration.
I don't know if Tumblr. No, I know with Tumblr, they don't control where the redirects in the links.
Uh-huh.
Pinterest controls that. So if you if you throw up a whole bunch of Amazon products on your Pinterest and you use your Amazon affiliate link and someone clicks on it, in about a minute, that affiliate link is a Pinterest affiliate link, because it's our site that's showing this stuff, not you.
Okay.
We're not doing it. So that's something that Tumblr doesn't do.
That clears things up a little bit, because I'm a little confused at what the distinction is between what Pinterest is doing and what other sites like Tumblr and
Delicious are doing.
Yeah.
Also, you have to take a look at the fact that Pinterest is so wholly focused on images, mm-hmm. that there's no context to those images either, right?
Right.
So,
I mean, they're lumped together by category,
that's
by the
about
users.
It.
Yeah.
Category and user. So with Tumblr, there's tons of images on Tumblr with no real context around them. But Tumblr is facing this problem, but it's not simply an image based thing. You can share a link on Tumblr, you can share an image, you can share your own copy you know, your own stories or whatever. You can share a bunch of things on Tumblr. Pinterest is only images. It's just images. So it's a big target for that lobby, you know? It's a big target for anybody who's interested in, you know, looking at what they're trying to do and saying, hey, that's my work. It's up there. Because all it is images, you know?
Could this
We're going to see a YouTube-like thing. It's going to, if you put something up there and someone complains about it, they're going to take it down. They're just going to work with this guy to figure out the best automated way to do that and the best way to make sure that people who do see things that are theirs or that people that, you know, the user didn't have the rights but it belongs to somebody else, they won't be able to simply sue Pinterest. They'll have to go through this process of, okay, it's going to be removed. We're going by the DMCA. We're doing this. We're doing that. You know, they're just going to make sure everything's like proper channeled situation. I feel like that's kind of what they're working on.
And the other one of the other stories that kind of gets lumped in this category of copyright content policing is occurred when the Oatmeal webcomic creator Matthew Inman got a recent lawyer letter demanding $20,000 of his money from the site funnyjunk.com because Funny Junk had claimed that he was slandering. Is it slandering?
It's slander. It's libel. It's basically he got janky on this guy, and he did it in a really public way.
Because Funny Junk
disparaged
was...
disparaged his wife, his mom.
Right. There's a very hilarious yet inappropriate image of that the Oatmeal drew of the rendition of Funny Junk's mother attempting to seduce a bear from behind.
It's not just attempting to seduce a bear from behind. She's drawn as incredibly overweight.
Yes.
Amazingly, you know, unattractive, varicose veins coming out from these clearly, you know, flat and enormous breasts. She's got wild hair, wild eyes, unkempt lipstick, you know, and she's going to a wild animal and saying, love me. So it's just an absurd rendering of a human being doing an absurd thing. And it truly is pretty – it's a pretty hard diss.
But the reason that he did that was because Funny Junk he got fed up with his comics appearing on Funny Junk posted by other users. Funny Junk is a user-generated humor site.
Yeah.
And so people would rehost his comics on Funny Junk.
Just like how they would on Pinterest. And he'd be the first guy to say, hey, Pinterest – I'm going to draw a picture of your mother or sue you.
He said that he said, I quote here, I realized that trying to police copyright infringement on the internet is like strolling into the Vietnamese jungle circa 1964 and politely asking everyone to use squirt guns. I know if Funny Junk disappeared, 50 other clones would pop up to take its place overnight, but I felt I had to say something about what they're doing. And yeah, Funny Junk responded to his complaints about them by asking for the $20,000 in remuneration for their libel or slander, to which he replied with the picture of the bear, the mother, the Funny Junk mother, seducing the bear. And he also put out a counter pledge out there. He asked the internet for for basically the money that Funny Junk was demanding, and he was going to take that money and split it evenly to send to the National Wildlife Federation and the American Cancer Society. And he actually got that amount in just over an hour, and since then he's received over $100,000 in donations in response to that request, which he's donating to those charities. It just brings up the whole, once again, to tie it into the same theme about copyright infringement. Mm-hmm. It's a difficult and it's a tricky minefield, of what to do with, because you can't control.
It hurts the big studios. It hurts the little guys. And the fact is, the internet is completely designed to share information.
Yeah,
and that's one of those things. So I'm not saying that the way the recording industry and motion picture industry of America is working is the right way. But we see the little guys also suffering from this, and people like new guys like Pinkster's lawyering up. We realize that this is a pretty serious situation, and that in a marketplace of ideas, you can't forget the marketplace part.
Right.
So
right. Some people want to be paid for their creation, mm-hmm. which drives the marketplace.
Exactly.
The bottom line is there's no real easy answer to this, and I think it's going to be something that's we're going to continue to fight these fights as we move through these early days, these relatively early days of the internet, until we figure all this out.
Exactly.
So should we tie it off? Should we call it a show?
Let's tie it off.
Yeah. All right. So Dwayne, where can we find you on the internet when you're not here on the Drill Down?
Twitter.com/DWAYNED. Twitter, Dwayne, that's Dwayne D. Gplus.to/DwayneD. And you can always find me here on the Drill Down.
You can find me at MrBabyMan.com, Gplus.to/MrBabyMan, where all my social links are. Check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our links are in the upper right-hand corner of the right sidebar. Facebook.com/TheDrillDown, Twitter.com/TheDrillDown. Sign up at j.mp/subus to get SMS alerts when The Drill Down goes live. That's a neat little feature that a lot of people are... I noticed that a lot more people have been using it since I've been mentioning it.
Mm.
If you got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. If you got a viewpoint of any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish. Let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location when we hopefully will be joined by... Hopefully we'll have all four of our members next week. We'll see. It's been kind of a crazy
month
in the tech world. But hopefully we can get everybody together for the show. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, guys.